Started here. We have three good topics this afternoon, and I know a couple of other business items, so we'll get started right away. First off, a presentation of the Alcatel-Lucent Internet Cable Utility Review. This is something we heard a proposal on several months ago, and we asked some of our internal staff to take a look at it. Who's going to lead off on that?
Dale? Or?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Peter Hogan. I'm with the Elkwood Utility, and back a few months ago, as Randy mentioned, the utility and city finance was asked to look into the business proposal that Alcatel-Lucent had made at the time regarding a internet cable utility. And by means of a little bit of a qualifier, this is not a complete business plan or anything like that. This was kind of a spreadsheet projection of what they would see or anticipate a utility like this would look like. And just to give you a bit of a preview of what we're going to go over the basically what the Alcatel-Lucent assumptions were. Then with those assumptions, what they came up with is a P&L and a cash flow for both the triple play, which the triple play is if you have cable, internet, and phone services. And also, we had them work one up that was just for an internet service only type of provider. Then we're going to follow that up with a couple of operational and financial risks and other considerations, and then open it up to your questions regarding what we presented so far. So with that, a little bit of the process that we followed here. We met with Alcatel-Lucent, and this was back in December the first time, and updated them with some of the assumptions based on what we know about the environment that we're in here. They went back and came back to us in the end of March, April with some updated information. We engaged Burns and Mack, who's an engineering firm. These guys were out of Kansas City, and had them just kind of have a look at it from a high level to see if there's anything really obvious that we've missed. And they had a number of recommendations coming back as well. Next one there. So getting into the assumptions, The build-out for the internet cable internet utility, their assumptions assume that we would have 30% penetration right here over within the first 3 years, basically, was the summary. Breakdown of residential and business side there, 4,500 and about 4,000 business accounts. Next one here, pricing obviously is fairly important anytime you're trying to model something like this. We have not done a full-blown market analysis or anything like that. Within the model, what they showed was kind of a breakdown on five different service levels, the top level being a 1 gigabit to the home type of a service at around $100.
Yeah.
If you look at that, the bottom three percentages here add up to 58%. That are more than $50 a month. A lot of your prevailing ones right now in the 60 megabit range, more in that around $50 range, or between about $39 and $50. We go on to the next one here on the assumptions. In order to set up an operation to run like this, we're looking at a number of people needing to be added. So kind of a breakdown there, different positions. We're looking at 20, 21 employees who need to be added. In the assumptions, we have the first year with essentially a half a year having people on board as we'd be ramping up if we were to go down this road. And then the staffing pretty much stays level or constant throughout the 3 to 5 year model, assuming that 30% penetration level. The next one here is talking about the capital requirements for the first 5 years. It's looking at a total capital investment of about $53 million on the just for the hardware and the installation and all that type of thing. One thing to note in this, while he said it's not a comprehensive business plan, the capital requirements, when we asked them to do the same thing without the cable and the voice, is essentially the same. So I think there's probably a little work to be done there to kind of really true up some of these numbers. But it gives you a pretty fair idea that we're talking about a $53 million investment there. $53 million and took the cash flow projection that they had and worked backwards to get back to what kind of funding would be needed. So it worked out basically total funds of about $59 million, and then to get that amount of money available to spend, by the time we do the capitalized interest, debt service reserves, and issuance costs, we're looking at about $66.4 million debt, basically, to go into the Fed. And a couple of assumptions down the bottom there, 3.5% in 20 years. So now that you've got all the assumptions, we start putting those together into financials. So this first one is the financials for the what they would call the triple play. And a couple of the key things to look at there is down here in the bottom, we don't have any taxes or payment in lieu of taxes or franchise fee, things like that. So that would be an add-on which would add to our expenses and push this number here, which is when we start seeing a positive income versus expense. Of course, this is all predicated on meeting all those other assumptions. So, that's pricing and the penetration as well, 30%. So, all these numbers are kind of subject to change, but it gives you a good high-level view of that. go on to the next one there. So then, if we take out things like depreciation that really are not a cash consumption, so we essentially, from operations, if we come down here in the, essentially this is the third year or 2.5 years in, we're looking at being a positive from a cash flow standpoint on the operations side, but we're still building out the facilities at that stage, so you're still a negative $15 million in cash, so we're still using up cash at that stage. We don't actually get to where, based on their presentation, they would be in the fourth year before they're looking at a positive cash flow overall. And then if you bring that down here, this is looking at borrowing the $59 million and then showing the uses of cash kind of happening. And this is kind of hopefully would be the end of when you're consuming cash. And then coming back here now where we start to see a positive cash flow from operations, we're no longer doing the build out at this stage. So we start to see those positive cash flows come down here and start getting in a position where you can start paying down debt more aggressively or doing other things within that realm. So this is for the what they call the triple play. And we've got the same thing for an internet only. The biggest difference here really is just on the revenue side, that we're showing less revenue because of the one of those earlier slides showed the adoptions of about 11% and 29% or 30% overall, but 11% for some of those other two services. So if you take those ones out and just leave the internet revenue, then we'd be looking at a somewhat lower revenue side. But then we still come into the same picture here, so we'll see that would be in the fourth year, essentially looking at a positive P&L. Again, there's no payment in lieu of tax or franchise fee in there, which would obviously impact the bottom line. Then the next one would be the cash flow again. Timing is fairly close to the same again in the cash flow from operations being in that second year, and then out into the fourth year again before you'd see after the build out, it's like that getting to a cash flow. I do have a small negative number there, which accountants don't like negative numbers in places like that. So, but probably not material. Essentially, we're saying that you manage the cash flows in that scenario. Again, we're still working with $59 million. And I think that one would change a little bit. That's why I didn't overreact to that $65,000 number there, just because I think the capital costs would also get adjusted a little bit more than what they currently show. Moving on to the operational risks, I think if you're looking at this kind of utility, there's probably three real key ones. If you look at the three pieces there, that cable TV is seeing increased competition from streaming through the internet. You see cell phones or phones moving to cell phones and away from landlines. And then on the internet side, you see an increase in cellular and wireless. So there's definitely rapidly changing technology there. And you look at that 60-month capital investment, you can imagine there's going to be some capital refreshment needed throughout that time frame as well. So once you get to 3 to 5 years, you'd usually being passed up by, you know, newer technology, so there's a constant refresh needed there. On the competition side, obviously there's incumbent vendors, and so we can also expect that competition to have an impact on us from a pricing standpoint, especially when you look at that graph where 58% of the revenue was over and had rates that are over $50 a month. So the addition of FTE, and then also the need to support that internally, you know, when you add, you know, 20 more employees plus, that puts a little bit more drain on other areas within the city as well. The next one on the financing side, so just get started. I think one of the things we try to come up with is, you know, it's kind of nice to look at the big numbers, but to just get started and do a business plan and a lot of that planning, we'd have to have some seed funds essentially to get started. Bonding, I think this is also a key one when it comes to financing, that bonding we'd have to, we talked to a couple of underwriters, a rating agency, and also our investment council for the city, and they all pretty much said that you're going to either have to put revenue bonds from one of the other utilities behind this, or some form of general obligation bond, typically for a startup, non-essential service like a utility. You get into situations there where it's a little harder to go to market and get kind of good pricing. So they're going to be looking for the city in this case to have some skin in the game or money in the game. So one of the other things that we're looking into a little bit here, and Terry can probably speak to this more clearly too, is just some of the hoops we need to jump through in order to be able to do some of these things, especially on the general obligation side, as far as having to go possibly to a referendum to get approval to be able to issue some of those kinds of debt things for non-essential service. And then this is the other thing that we see out there is just the potential impact when it's a non-essential service, you know, on their borrowing for other things, whether that be the utility or the city. A number of different cities that we've looked at have done it different ways, either as a partial GO obligation behind it or pledging revenue bonds from either like the utility or some other enterprise. Next one, there, Dan. Some other considerations. As an internet-only provider, we're doing some research on this, talking to some of our council, and you know, it appears that as an internet-only provider, you don't run into some of the restrictions that you have with telephone and cable, where you need to be a franchise provider. There's a statute in Minnesota about having to build out in 5 years in order to cover the entire footprint of the city, and becoming an FCC telephone provider. There's some question on that on the internet one, but we have to do some more work and get some definitive opinions on that. There would be a couple of just things internally that we'd need to do around the charter to provide this kind of utility. I think there's a couple of different options that have been looked at in the past around that as well. And again, I'm sure Terry can speak more to those ones than I could. There's a prohibition against cross subsidies between utilities, so that would be another thing to be aware of. Obviously, there'll be legal expenses and more than likely challenges from people that provide similar services in town. And kind of be aware that our current franchise revenue for 2015 is about $1.4 million. So you know, anytime we're going down this, there's a bird in the hand type of thing as well. So just kind of be aware of that. That's the other piece there. I think that was down to questions. So I know that was a really quick flyby of a whole bunch of information, so I expect a whole bunch of questions.
Can I just ask a clarification?
Yes.
This is not an RPU proposal. This was finance and RPU finance review of Alcatel's proposal, and you revised the numbers accordingly. But this isn't, these aren't your assumptions or
not.
Your okay.
No, this
qualifier
was,
is.
Alcatel basically, you know, had come and made the presentation to the council, and we were asked to evaluate their proposal, which is what we did. I think that, that's kind of why I touched there, that to go into this
in a lot of depth, you'd really want to look at doing a true business plan and building your own assumptions. Instead of just taking, you know, $53 million as your capital, you'd actually want to go and get some quotes and find out what it really would take. You'd want to get a lot more definitive when you're dealing with numbers like that.
I mean, we did some reviews of the build-out information and stuff that they had in there, and RPU had their own staff that made them go back and reevaluate that based on what they knew about Rochester and so forth. But a lot of it really comes down, I mean, those made minor changes to their assumptions and the full profitability of it, but the real thing comes down to that assumption of a 30% penetration of it. And again, that's based on the current pricing structure of the competitors in town, and as soon as you start getting into that business, you know, they probably start changing. I mean, we talked to our financial advisor about this, and he said he's got a stack of market studies that, you know, the expensive ones we're talking about later, that make all these various projections, but they end up getting blown away because the competitors were willing to undercut them for a long period of time before they, and so they didn't end up meeting those expectations of the market penetration, that kind of thing. So it just, because of that, the bonding question, and I've got a whole other section we could go into if we have time for it, but I don't, I've got other things on the agenda today. But that whole selling the bond themselves, Peter and I talked to these underwriters, and they're basically saying there's no way that they sell them by themselves anymore as a standalone, because they've had too many stories where they failed. There's, you know, there's certainly success stories, but there have been others that have failed, and so they definitely want something else wrapped into it, either another utility or a GO back. And Terry maybe wants to say this whole, even under an internet only, the question about whether or not we even have the authority to do it becomes a big part of that whole bonding question. I mean, there's certainly ones that have done it in different manners, but under Section 429, there's express authority to get into internet services, but you have to meet some challenges that would be tough. I mean, they're really designed more for some of the more rural communities that have no other services like that. It would be tough for Rochester to meet some of the tests that are in 429. But again, I don't know how much we want to get into that today, but.
Mr. Atkins.
My name has been mentioned a few times, so I may as well jump in. There is a statute that says before a city can operate a telephone exchange, it must seek approval from the voters. And if there is an existing telephone exchange in the city, that approval must be in the amount of 65%. You remember Brian Grogan, he is our telecommunications expert lawyer who's assist us in such matters. And he has performed some legal research and has indicated that even though we may provide internet only, cities who have followed that suit in that practice in Minnesota have complied with the statute. And his recommendation is that we do likewise, or build in a sufficient amount of money for a legal challenge from incumbent providers, because they surely will challenge us if we don't. And so, at a minimum, I would think you would have to plan on submitting this to the electorate and having 65% or more approving it before you go down the road.
The reason for that, I know you're sitting there puzzled, but yeah. The reason for it is that anybody can throw on a VoIP system once you have the internet.
Right.
And at that point, some people say, well, now you have a telco. If you just show that one person is running their own VoIP system on this, you have a telco going on.
VoIP being voice over internet protocol.
Yeah. I mean,
again, whether or not. It's just the possibility, the challenge of it, that other cities have gone ahead and had the referendum. And again, if you're going to throw a GO behind this anyway, if you're going to need a referendum anyway, because there is no other authority without a referendum to put that kind of a capital expenditure out there.
Mr. Wojcik.
Well, I don't believe for a second that for internet only we need a referendum, but that's another topic for another time. My question on the bonding, Longmont, Colorado just did this. And my understanding is they did a revenue bond.
I looked this up. This is actually electric, and they pledged electric revenues.
They pledged electric against the
it's actually combined
against it.
The cable utility is actually a subdivision.
So my understanding then from Longmont was that they had when the market got theirs, they actually viewed the effective rating of the bond, but the market thought it was such a good investment, they actually drove the prices up and made it look like a AAA bond offering because the market was so accepting of the product. And then also, I was a little bit nervous when I heard that we were assuming 30% penetration, because that's an incredibly conservative number. If we go back to the RPU study that we sent out in terms of what our you know, what the electorate wanted. I think about 80% wanted us to look at possibly offering broadband, and about 30% were so enthusiastic about RPU they'd probably jump at any product we offered. So that's a very conservative figure for us. And I checked, it looks like Longmont, Colorado's up to about 49% penetration with theirs. And Longmont is a fascinating example because it's a city that geographically is about the same size as Rochester. Population is very similar to Rochester. Demographics are quite similar to Rochester. Their incumbents actually offer far better service than we can get here in Rochester, so they're more competitive than our current ones. And, you know, they've kind of blown the top off this thing, and something, you know, 60-some other municipalities in Colorado followed suit. Now, they did it, I think, with a 50-50 referendum using the revenue bonds. But the fact that this shows with either option how quickly you become cash flow positive while delivering a pretty important service that's not currently available at these kind of speeds and qualities to people be a pretty big win for the community. I obviously, the step that's needed and would have to be the next step would be to actually do a full market study to make sure, see what that penetration rate would be. But both the survey that we did with the public with RPU and this preliminary data indicates that there is a very strong business plan for this to be available.
I had one question, and you're right, we kind of flew through the slides, but on the slide that had the potential pricing modeling,
yes.
And if I understood in the 5% and either end tail end of the curve, it looked like it was projected that the majority of customers would pay between $50 and $85 a month. Is that, am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, if you looked at this here, you know, if you were just taking an average, you're going to end up somewhere in this range here. So.
And the reason that I point that out is I know that as the proposal was originally presented and discussed, and I think we have to be very honest with the public, because I think they get this impression that they can, most of them can get the $9.95 price, but they have to realize that that's going to be a very limited amount of service. To get the kind of speed that they want in internet and the kind of video services and so forth, they're probably going to be more in the middle part of that bell curve. Just my observation.
Yeah, and the $9.95, I mean, to be broadband, you have to be 25 meg down, so it'd be fine for streaming video. But going back to Longmont, what they've been able to successfully do with their pricing model is they offer a 25-25 option, which is actually far better on the upload than most anyone can get in Rochester for $40 a month. They offer a 1 gig, 1 gig. It's regularly $100, but if they take service in the first 6 months, it drops down to $50 for 1 gig bisymmetric access. That's 17-18 times faster download and 250 times faster upload than what Charter can offer the community, and for $10 less. And even if you don't take in the first one, they have a $100 one gig is the base price, but they drop it to $60 after a year of service. So I think that kind of the mean kind of probably falls right in where their mean of this one is, but there's not as much of a standard deviation. They also offer some other broadband options for lower income folks, but you know, the fact that it's similar communities are being so successful in this field with this kind of pricing says that we can probably offer a far better service for similar or less than what we're paying today.
The only other question I had is on the financials. The capital expense up front I understand, but is it factored in? This is technology.
Yep.
It's moving quickly. Is there a line item that factors in an ongoing investment to maintain whatever the newest technology is?
The model that they did actually goes out, so they start having a refresh around that 5-year stage. Now, the big investment, which is the fiber in the ground, that's kind of like the one-time up front. It's actually the technology on the other end for communication that is the piece that ends up being the refresh. So
the technology refresh is factored in as we
there is a technology refresh.
In about year five, but not on this slide, not on these slides here, it's in the following year.
We're capturing money for it right. Throughout this. Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yeah. When you kind of project this and keep on going out, 15, 20 years.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
Just the pricing that you have there, it says at the top that it's internet cable, that's a triple play pricing that you're showing here. This is for all three services or for one service?
This was all three.
Okay, so I would be getting cable.
And I think that's where you've got to go back and look at your you've got to go back and look at your real marketing assumptions.
Yeah.
And this isn't looking at competition.
I'm not sure, because that's internet residential. think that might just be the internet section of it. I know the heading says all there, but I think this particular pricing is just the internet.
That's good to know. That'd be something to double check, I guess. And maybe I can talk you through a mental hoop I'm trying to get through, because I understand this competitive nature of the business a little bit, but $67 million investment over 20 years. We have, let's say, 20,000 homes that end up using this, like 12 months in a year. We're talking about if we can reduce the price either through our service or through the existing competitive services by $14, we've netted out that difference, distributed amongst all the taxpayers of Rochester. I mean, is it safe to look at it that way? I mean, if we reduce the price of competitive services and they become better and people continue buying Charter, but I'm able to, through competition, reduce the price by $25, we're still a win.
It depends on your goal. Yeah.
Right.
But this does put $60 million additional burden on something, because it's either going to be the electric utility, and again, keep in mind, they're ready to go to the market pretty darn quick on another peak power plant, and or it's something putting additional debt burden on capacity we have on our GO side, and we keep talking about all the additional needs we have on the GO side as well, too. So, it affects the police precinct and everything else, so you have to start deciding how do you divvy out the debt capacity, and it is bringing down the price of internet for customers the right thing to do with that, then fine. I'm not making, we don't make that decision, but those are other decisions you're making.
Others? Mr. Milbeck.
Yeah, I got a question from Michael. You said that Longmont has better capability than what we have or what we will have.
The existing incumbent there, I think it's Comcast, can offer better services to the home than Charter can currently offer here in Rochester.
All right, but if we did this...
Oh, we'd be the same as Longmont. Fiber to the home basically allows you any speed that's effectively available in the marketplace.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, so obviously I kind of ask the same question all the time, where has it been successful before? You've given an example. We'd have to look at the details there, because prior to this, kind of the one you always heard trotted out was Chattanooga, Tennessee, but they had a huge federal, subsidy to build out their system. So obviously the underlying assumptions and what's similar and what's different. And then ideally, has anybody else in Minnesota been successful doing this? Because a lot of times, the regulations within the state are going to be more similar, obviously, for a Minnesota-based effort. So I would definitely want to see some examples before we would go forward, that because we certainly know there's many that have tried and failed. And I just look at it from, Charter. If I was Charter, I would undercut us on price. And they're a very big company. They can afford to do that for a long time. And those are my concerns.
Mr. Bilbeck?
Wasn't that up in last summer? Have we looked at how that...
I don't believe that went well. I do think there was...
You will. Good, because...
I said not very well.
Not well. But Rendell, just like how that...
There were more...
Yeah, different set of circumstances. It's hard to compare those.
And again, it depends what your goal is. I always hear that it didn't go well, and you're right. What happened in Monticello is they put in a fiber-to-the-home network, and AT&T then immediately put in a fiber-to-the-home network, and Charter, whoever the cable company was, did the exact same thing. And up there, I think you get like a gig for $35 or something like that right now. So it all if your goal is to have world-class services for your community, Monticello won. Now the financials fell apart in that whole system. But again, I think those were entirely revenue bonds, so it's not the... I don't think it was the taxpayers that got hit on that
one. We'd have to get more information. I was mentioning that
Monticello was a complete failure.
Yeah, well, that's what I want to make sure that if something of that nature were to happen here, it doesn't come back onto us to come up with that.
Well, but see, that's, I think, the problem is because of the Monticellos and ones like that, you cannot issue a straight revenue bond. I think you might be right. Yep. Monticello might have done a straight revenue bond, so it's just it fell to the bondholders. Other than Monticello's name, I don't think it affected their taxpayers. But what we're hearing from the people we talk to in the financial markets is you can't sell one like that right now because of the ones that have failed. Mm-hmm. So you have to wrap your utility into it, or you have to wrap your GO bond into it, so that if it does start to fall apart financially, you're going to have to tax the taxpayers if it's a GO backing, or you're going to have to increase utility rates to make those payments get made, or they're going to have enough cash. you won't have the option of just saying, well, I guess it didn't work out and the bondholders are left with it.
Okay, other questions?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir?
I think that most of the ones that do our public things in Minnesota tend to be subsidized by state and kind of rural areas. Paul Bunyanet does a great job in north central part of the state of Minnesota. But Darius, in terms of cities this size and this geography, there aren't a whole lot to compare to in Minnesota. But Longmont is the one that, and I've spoken with them directly, and they're willing to give us some information on how theirs is working. But you try and find out some models that have worked elsewhere, and I think theirs is kind of a glowing example of how it can be done correctly. And not only that, but also how much it improves the business climate of their community, because it's not just helping kids get affordable broadband access to, for their education, but also businesses really do an incredible amount, because with Charter's upload speeds, it's just not viable as a business option in Rochester, and that's what the only thing that covers most of the community. And one other thing I throw as a possibility, too, is there's also the ability to, I'm interested in provided broadband, not necessarily having our own broadband monopoly. And I think that there are models after the incumbents are done fighting us over it. I think there's the potential that if we have fiber to the home, that they could potentially lease some of the capacity from us as well and deliver their own services that way. Because right now, the core neighborhoods, the places that need good broadband access, just aren't getting it from any incumbents. I mean, new areas, people are happy to run fiber, but right now the central areas are not great. And maybe one last lesson learned from Longmont in talking with them, they actually worked very closely with their public works department, and there are some very simple policies that we could put in place, like, if you're putting in conduit when you're doing any sort of a road project, anytime you're tearing up a street, you're putting conduit underneath so that it's easier to do this in the future. And they frankly leaned on their public works department to help with the build out of the system as well. And we've got a pretty outstanding public works department here who's a potential partner for that. But if we're going to make a rational decision on this, I think looking more into Longmont is probably a good step for staff to do, and also doing the market study. You can't really come to a conclusion on what's saleable in this community and what the end product will look like without doing a market study. And the market study would be critically important.
Going back to Mr. Hickey's comment, do you know what they did for bonding?
Well, they bonded $43 million, and it sounds like it was a they advertised it as for the internet system, but apparently they also had a secondary backer of being
the official
electric
statement. Actually, it's actually wrapped together with their electric.
Yep.
And the actual statement is an official statement. You can't do it separate. It's a sub-department or a subsidiary group of the electric.
Interestingly, they must have done something, because their bond, the referendum that they did there, specifically said that the funds for the utility could only come from the broadband utility itself. They couldn't be parasitic towards the other utilities. So I don't know exactly how that works, but.
Well, there are some of those issues.
But the good thing in their case is they're so far ahead of their projections that they're building it out early and paying it off early.
And again, one of the things we haven't talked about, I mean, there might be other options. Some of the other cities have done sort of a partnership thing. They do an RFP,
yep.
RFP with, and they do a private-public partnership arrangement. Yep. And some of those were already telcos, so they didn't have to deal with the telco law issue, and they basically provided some abatement bonds, using abatement as an economic development angle, mm-hmm. and said, this is what we're going to do. And they partnered up with somebody else. They did an RFP that everybody else can apply, including Charter, if they wanted, and then evaluated those and moved forward on that basis. So, there are other options to consider here.
Going back to the referendum question real quick, I heard a couple of comments related to Chapter 429 and then the financing. So is it required that we take this to a referendum, or just strongly advised?
As to the bonding issue?
Either way.
Well, 429 is the bonding chapter.
Okay.
And I assume that's a requirement. I haven't looked at that.
No. Well, actually, the problem with 429 is that
Well, while he's looking for it, in terms of the statute that Brian has pulled up, it's required.
So for telecom.
For a telephone exchange.
Right.
And the question is, and it's not completely resolved, if you're just going to do internet only, is that a telephone exchange? We don't believe it is. Other cities, however, didn't want to fight that fight and said, we'll act as if it does.
so we're not challenged by it, and we don't spend our money on lawyers.
And there was proposed legislation to get that out of state statutes because they say that's antiquated because the telco isn't what it was at the time they wrote that statute.
Okay.
But under 429, to do it without, I mean, to have express authority to do this, internet services, it says under there, so to construct, extend, maintain facilities for internet access and other communication purposes, if the council finds that, so you need to have these findings, that the facilities are necessary to make available internet access or other communication services that are not and will not be available through other providers of the private market in the reasonably foreseeable future. And that the services provided by the facilities will not compete with services provided by private entities.
Okay. All right. Well, but as you say, that's a question for another day, mm-hmm. more detail. Ms. Means, you have
just to help me understand, you have given this presentation based on the information from Alcatel.
Yep.
And you will do your own market study to validate these.
We haven't been directed.
That's up to us.
Yes, I understand.
That. So the request was just to evaluate the hotels.
Okay, but then if the council directed it, then you do your own market study.
As long as the council directed and funded it, yeah.
And funded it. That was my next question.
And that was kind of what I put in there, but the seed funds to kind of get going.
I was real surprised about the cost and about the legal challenges.
The piece of that is not that, but I think you actually, the part of the problem is people, too. You're going to have people and to actually do the work and represent us and go down that road as well. So it's not, I'm looking at that as probably about an 18-month, two people. This is like going down the road of pulling all the things together. If you really want to go down that road, before you get to anything like issuing a bond, you're probably going to spend close to $1 million. So, if you're heading down that road, I just kind of want to be clear up front. So when you're doing your budget,
they spent as much on this as they can.
No, I just wonder where. I'm just trying to get some baseline understanding of it. That's all. Thank you.
Okay.
Well,
so,
there's one other question. I'm sorry, I forgot. Will you do the survey, or how will you contact the public and get their opinions? And
we would actually go to a third party to do that, just like we do some of the engagement surveys and things like that. So we would go looking for a vendor that really does this kind of work, because you really need to have a good understanding. It really does boil down to that level of adoption and price of the service. And to what Michael's saying with Longmont, that essentially $50 a month, but they've got 40-50% adoption. The reason the Monticello's didn't work out is they didn't have 30% adoption. So if it's this whole equation, just like any business out there, of dollars and adoption. So that's kind of the whole balancing act. That's why understanding the market, and probably one of those early people you'd wanted to have in there would be a market person to work out how you position yourself if you want to go down that road. So.
Thank you.
I do want to clarify just for the council's information. Peter's using the term "we" a lot in this conversation. Originally, the council requested that the utility board take some action, and the utility board did approve payment for the Burns and Mac contract to kind of oversee the Alcatel. If there's additional funds and resources and things that the council wishes the utility to get involved in, I think that probably needs to come back to the utility board and eventually get there. Blessing that they're interested in committing utility resources to this endeavor. Otherwise, it would have to be city staff that would take this on in terms of a market research study and further research. So.
That actually leads into my next question with respect to time. I would ask the council what would be the preferred next step? Would we refer this to the RPU board, or what would be the next step?
I would suggest three next steps done in parallel. One, obviously sending this to the RPU board as well, but one, ask staff to work with Longmont to analyze the similarities between the two systems. Second would be to fund the market study portion of this, which is going to answer those critical price versus market penetration numbers. And third is get some answers to these bonding questions, because I'm not ever heard from anyone in the industry that a referendum is required for something like this, certainly not a two-thirds referendum. And in fact, we have an organization here, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who's talked to us that specifically points that out as well. But if we could get those three things done, I think those are the appropriate next steps to keep this thing moving.
Mr. Hickey, then Ms. Mean.
So, I mean, I'd like to know what a ballpark is in a marketing study before we commit to that step, because I assume that's going to be a rather expensive next step. And so far, I've got a lot more questions than anything else, you know, even before I'm willing to take that step of a marketing study. I'd have to look at this Longmont, Colorado, but so far I've seen the ones, you know, kind of focused on the ones that haven't been successful. I need to look a little bit more at the ones that have been successful.
And one thing I've kind of going a little deeper on that, one thing I would ask is who on our staff is best suited to, if we ask them to look at the Longmont study or scenario?
It's a utility that runs it there. So, and I've sat and talked with their general manager and a few other people from their utility, so we probably want to involve the utility.
So would it be back to the utility board or an RPU to take the lead on doing that deeper analysis of Longmont? That's a question.
The utilities board was fairly clear to me about their desire to explore the option. I don't know why we wouldn't give them first right to act on taking the lead on this. This is clearly the direction they're getting from their user base. So I don't know why we should be the only fire lit here. Let's see what they'll do. I mean, I think what's been laid out is pretty general.
And I was just trying to get clarity on that. The comment was made to ask staff to look at this. Who is what I was trying to zero in on.
I went through my mental Rolodex pretty quick, and RPU people keep coming to the top. So I think that's a really good spot to maybe take this back to your utility board and figure out if they're willing to act on it and report back to us. If they decide not to, we can take this up again for some.
And they would give us a estimated cost to do that deeper analysis.
I don't know if they need to. If it's internal and they're funding it internally, it comes out of their budget. I mean, they would.
Yeah, it wouldn't be in our budget, though.
No.
Yeah. If we couldn't go out and do something like that in our budget.
No.
It's
they're
because
they're going to come back and ask for money.
At the direction of their board.
Right now RPU RPU is authorized to do electric and water work. You know, there's a little bit of a gray area that they have internal communications needs that they need this for, but it's a lot cleaner to simply have them figure out what they need and have both their board and our board authorize it.
Okay.
Yeah. Did I say that fair? Is that fair?
Yeah, I would, just as a cautionary note, money is one thing, staff time is something else, and we've got a lot of initiatives on our plate currently, so we would have to have conversations with the board to see what we aren't going to do if we're doing this. Not to say that we couldn't at some point in time get this figured into the work plan, but we're heavily involved in the electric and the water, and our plates are full, to be honest with you, so we'll have to have discussions with the board and see whether or not this is something that we can actually take on with existing staff and existing workload.
So the request has been stated in terms of going deeper on the Longmont situation and the market study, et cetera. So with those questions in mind, would we refer this back to the utility board for their opinion? Mr. Bilderman?
Yeah, I would be willing to ask the utility board what they're willing to take on. I would ask to research the Longmont as well as ask Mr. Adkins and his group to look at the 65%
the referendum
issue, and then try to figure out what the cost of a market study would be without going much further until we see what kind of cost the market study would be. Bringing that back to us and to see if the utility board wishes to participate in that. If they don't, then that obviously is going to be another issue we're going to have to figure out, is who on staff would be the ones that would look at it. So I'd be willing to ask the utility board to take a look at what they're willing to do. I'd be willing to ask the utility board and Dale and Terry to look at the Longmont situation and also look at some of these that were unsuccessful and what kind of cost came back to the taxpayers in the base of the city. And ask Oshel look to see what it would cost to do a market study, without going much further than that, so that we're aware of what that cost is going to be to us before we get there.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, this may not have any bearing on this, but just to clarify something, I just looked it up. We are 20,000 people more than Longmont. We are not close to being. It'd be like comparing us to Duluth.
Okay,
where's that?
So, point well taken.
It's pretty close.
Can we also 15%? Have some idea what the legal exposure would be?
15%?
It seems like it's secondly, the staffing issue has already been mentioned several times, so could we consider a consultant rather than a staff person?
So with that in mind, and we're going to ask the board, utility board, to take a look at it, what sort of time frame would you have in mind before you could come back with some advice or recommendation?
I guess I would ask the man.
That's sort of wrong.
Okay. No. Don't look at me and say that.
I'm being polite.
I can't answer that. Ask the man.
We have a board meeting tomorrow night, which is probably too soon to have any real detailed discussion. So the next time the board would have an opportunity would be the August board meeting, end of August. We could potentially come back with something in the September time frame. I'll hear what your thoughts are, but assuming the board makes a decision at the August meeting and what direction they want.
As a point of clarification, are you anticipating that the funding would come from the council? Because there's two different things here. One's funding, which, you know, because of our charters, we can't take, you know, electric revenues and use them over here. Mm-hmm. So that's so there's a funding issue, there's a people issue. So
is the funding issue, so you said that we couldn't do it. What else can we do besides pay for it?
You have to pay for it somewhere. Okay.
Well, then I guess we would take, if we're, I guess I would throw out there that they should consider us as being willing to pay.
Mr. Kleinbold?
So you had some discussion about looking at the referendum. I mean, from my observation, this is a non-essential service with some significant risks, and I think as a minimum, the public should be weighing in on the expenditure of $60-some million for a venture such as this. So I would think that if you plan to go down that road, that you should consider that referendum as an essential item.
You're saying that broadband is a non-essential service?
It's not an essential city service.
Interesting.
And it is offered by the private sector.
Broadband is?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's something that the private sector offers, and I think government should be somewhat restricted in how much they compete with the private sector that does offer non-essential services to citizens. So it might be one.
Okay. All right. So are we clear on what we're requesting the RPU board?
We'll have it on the agenda for the September board meeting.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Kochever, could you just kind of mention this at the meeting tomorrow and see if everyone says yes, they're with you, or it sounds good, or anything positive?
I'm on the spot, but our board president is in the audience.
Where is he?
He's the one who just ducked down. He's the one who's going
out. All right.
I will.
237.
I can't speak for the board. I can only speak for myself. So we were a little reluctant in the first place because there are some of the walls up that we've heard about. It's not in our charter to provide this. So. But we thought, well, the direction of the council, fine. We know people, Burns and Badger is a great firm. We've talked to them. It shouldn't take too much time, but I'm afraid it did. Peter burned a lot of hours, as some of our staff did. So that was our concern. This is a new one. This is out of the blue to us, and we do have a lot of things going on, and the budget's full, right? We collect enough money to pay for what we plan for, and this is unplanned.
Okay.
But I would think that it would be reasonable to at least put together estimates so that we can come back and say, well, this is the kind of money we are not going to find.
Right. We appreciate it's not free. Okay, I'm going to move on then to our next topic for this afternoon, which is a discussion of speed bumps on the state aid street.
Where's everyone going?
That's not an interesting topic.
I drive over them every day on Fairway Drive.
All right. Not for long.
Everybody wants to leave. I thought people would be flooding the place.
All right, speed bumps. And we have Mr. Cabral.
Yes.
Here from MnDOT.
to explain this topic to us.
I am Carlos Cabral. I work for the state aid division of MnDOT. My job is specifically charged in District 6. My card is going around as a District 6 state aid engineer to support and advocate for the state aid issues that the cities have in the use of the state aid funding for its system. And what you're calling speed bump, for me, has a different name.
Can you say it in public?
You can. I try to call, the engineer department is very competent and discuss with them. As I heard on the TV, somebody says a great department. And I will explain the issues that I have as far as, not myself, but state aid has. When you're creating a state aid system, is to provide the higher tier routes, collectors, arterials, with as being part of the state aid network that's eligible to receive state aid funding. And one portion of my job is to bring forward the state rules and regulations, make sure everybody is understanding them and using them. The other part of my job, and our job is state aid, because I don't work alone, we are about a group of 50 folks between St. Paul office and the other eight districts, two in District 6 in Rochester, Minnesota, is to provide support for the development of the plans that are compatible or in compliance with state aid rules, and when there's a federal plan that's also compliant with all the federal rules and regulations, and we do other duties assigned. And third, I am also the advocate for the state aid cities and counties in the DOT. It's my charge to bring our issues for the DOT. So I used to be a DOT person. Today I call myself a state aid person, which is with the charge of our division. So, but that said, I don't think there is a speed bump issue, but yet one of the elements that state aid statewide requires, as the road are allowing all modes of transportation to circulate. And when you put a speed bump, you preclude some of the heavier traffic from using those routes. And there are other ways to do the same thing without using speed bumps. The engineering department can work on that one. And the other option I gave to the engineering department was we can reallocate that state aid mileage to a different higher tier route as well. So these are the issues that I brought forward to the state aid, and I'm very happy to be here today to present who we are in state aid. And I noticed those speed bumps accident. I live in Rockin' Town, and I drove my daughter to a friend's house. I said, it can happen that way. And that's why I brought those issues together to your department. Any other questions you have?
And I understand there are two specific roadways that
two specific roadways, yes. Yes. And we're open to work with your engineering department to figure out what to do and what are the issues you guys want to work with.
How does that work? I understand, you know, oftentimes policy is meant to be overarching and not necessarily deal with unique situations and scenarios. So how do you handle that in a community or municipality where the conditions are such that, you know, more restrictive controls like speed bumps, speed tables, and so forth are a preferred option to better manage traffic from a public safety standpoint? How do you deal with those more specific cases?
The engineer decision belongs to the engineering department, not to us.
Okay.
We are only the overseers of the policies. And we support the engineering department in to figure out the best way of making those rules available to use the state aid funding. In the case of one of the roads that's more in the southern portion of town, here by County Road 22, I think, or 25, they're close.
Yeah.
Fox Valley Drive.
Fox Valley Drive. You don't need to remove the whole road off the system if you want to. You could leave the road there. But also, there are other options you could use to slow traffic down. These are issues that I don't want to put my finger on because I only try to help my customers.
Mr. Wojcik, then Mr. Campion.
What cost-effective options would we have for slowing the speed down on Fox Valley Drive besides
the I don't know. I really don't, because I didn't do the study to figure it out.
I mean, we have an engineering department, too, and that's what our engineering department came up with. But, you know, nobody likes having MnDOT come down and, you know, tell the people that live on these streets that oftentimes experience speeding because of the very same MnDOT state aid standards that promote speeding. So I want to know, do we have the ability perhaps to designate all but, let's say, the 8 feet of the street where the speed tables are as state aid streets?
The system is constituted by roads that have continuity. It touches higher type roads. For example, a county road or another state aid system, a road from the system, or collector or arterial. So it can be reconfigured to allow the city to use its policies to address the issue the city has. Far from us to try to tell you what to do.
Mr. Campion.
So I appreciate you coming today to talk to us, and I'm not at all, I understand kind of your position on this, and you're trying to be our advocate, and so I guess what I would ask for is a little advocacy for temporary measures we take in response to construction traffic.
We are open to that.
Okay.
As long as we are informed about them and how we're going to go about them.
Okay.
We're not saying, I never said we're going to do this tomorrow, and we will resolve this issue tomorrow. We're flexible.
Great.
We know this goes against the regulation, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to bring a sword in.
Please don't.
No.
He's the guy.
There's no intention of doing that. We would like to work together because it's the nature of our job to work with our clients.
And I just want to maybe reiterate, I think some of the ones on Fairway Drive, for instance, you know, I think we demonstrated a bit of restraint because I was presented with a proposal that had 3 speed bumps in it, and I said, let's knock it down to 2, and let's go out there with 2 and see where that leaves us. Mm-hmm. And universally minus 1, that has been lauded as a great measure that has dramatically changed the experience for traffic along that corridor.
I agree.
And so I would like to see, rather than a huge engineering solution where I don't know, he's going to put chicanes or something in there that make it much more challenging. We had these, I don't know, couple hundred dollar speed bumps that we could put out there that seemed to alleviate it for a couple months. Okay, it's 2 years. This 2-year construction project that we're in the middle of. I think we get the purpose of the program, and we're really grateful, frankly, to have the state support for a lot of our local roadways that need it. So I don't want to in any way jeopardize the relationship, and I think it's been a good and beneficial one that we've had working through this. You know, and as long as we can reach some like practical conclusions about this, I'm looking forward to working with you.
We are open to figure out solutions.
Perfect.
I have Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Wojcik.
And I will say I'm not familiar with the issue except for the discussion we're having today. Is this something that's a recent change, or why are we having the discussion
No,
now?
No, this is a statewide policy. Actually,
okay.
There's not a city in my region. I have to go do the same thing, talk to them, because I found out that they have a speed bump. And the problem is that the state aid is supposed to have the heavier traffic, the heavier volume, so forth. Not the speedy traffic, but the heavier volume traffic. And when we put a speed bumps, we take away some of that vehicle transportation, which defeats the purpose of the road to being our system, our state aid system, okay? So
yeah,
it's my job come to the, I call it dark side of state aid.
Sure.
The enforcement of the,
yep,
the regulations.
Welcome to my world.
And again, not being familiar with the issue, what is it, I'm not,
there are
what does it preclude?
Speed bumps in a couple roads in town.
Right.
One is Fairway.
Yep.
The construction of 55th Street, we rerouted traffic, and on the route that we rerouted it, we installed some temporary speed bumps because there was speeding concerns with that. So when we put those in, it caught the attention of MnDOT because we weren't aware of the policy of not
and
allowing.
And I'm not policing for that. I found it by accident.
Yeah.
And actually, there's no need for the department to tell me because we have discussed the issue. And, and I'm sure they did everything in good faith, trying to find the cheapest solution possible, which is good.
And just back to the, I'm just trying to understand the basic issue. What traffic does it preclude? There's load weight limitations?
Or the collector routes, the routes that take the smaller streets, connect the traffic and direct it to the main gateways in town or the major routes in town. Those are the heavier circulation routes. And that's where the state aid funding from the gas tax is applied to in the state of Minnesota.
No, I guess my question was just for like the speed limit. Does it preclude like truck traffic or heavier traffic that can't negotiate?
Does that.
Okay.
You know, because of the type of transportation you have. Actually, on a side note, DOT heard is having a hard time with some of the Highway 90 traffic that came from Hormel because there was some sensitive equipment with vibration being damaged.
Okay.
So, see, so some trucks may have that.
Sure.
Most of them in Rochester may not have.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Well, one technical question, then perhaps a proposal. My technical question is, I believe that MnDOT is still still must respect statute 160.263, bicycle lanes and ways, which says that any road that has a bicycle lane painted on it, we can actually design for a 25-mile-per-hour speed instead of a 30-mile-per-hour speed. That would still apply to these streets, right?
It does.
Okay, so we don't at least have to ever design for 30 miles per hour. We can, with some paint, make it 25.
And if there is any problem, I can help your city secure a variance to the rules and explain to a committee that supports the state aid engineer, which is in St. Paul, and explain the reasons. And we have done this before. We had situations, we had a need for a parking stalls we reduced from the rules, and we successfully helped the city defend their case.
And the proposal would be, you know, we've looked at some of these and those speed tables. I live near them on Fox Valley. I've been there for probably as long as I've been in Rochester. My proposal would be, let's take a look at the problem, and if your engineers can come up with a cost-effective way to calm speed on those roadways, I think that's something that we could look at implementing. But in the meantime, I would just like to perhaps leave them in place until we have a acceptable solution to solve the problem otherwise.
I am not willing to intervene in the city's engineering department and solution finding issues. It's not part of my charge. Actually, it's the reverse. I'm supposed to bring the issues from the city to the DOT as the state aid person defending the city issues. Unfortunately, I'm also charged with making sure the regulations are applied properly. And we can negotiate solutions with your competent professionals you have and come to good terms. I don't see any problem here.
Mr. Bilbeck.
My question is, since you have this toolbox, is that something you open and would readily let the city see or use?
The city knows everything. Actually, we help them. We help them understand what's going on. As I said, we are in the state of Minnesota short of 50 folks working for the state aid division. And each district, we have two professionals working, and we do the plans review, the environmental reviews, construction inspection, bridge reviews, everything, the two of us. And it's, we don't have ability to do engineering studies. We use the knowledge that your engineers bring to us to help them solve their own problems.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. So with all that said, and again, with respect to time, what would be the next step, Richard?
I don't think there's anything to be done. I think we're fully in compliance with the policy. There's nothing in the policy that says that an individual point within the route, the speed can't be reduced to below 30. All the studies that we've done on these corridors, the before and after, show that the after speed is still 30 miles per hour or above. We're lowering the speed from 40 to 30 with these things. So there's an individual, you can't go over speed table more than 20. But the travel on that Fox Valley Drive corridor, every time we test it, is still above 30 miles per hour. The travel time, it computes then to a miles per hour. So we believe we're fully in compliance with a policy because there is no rule. There is no firm set of rules that you have to follow. There's just a policy. And as far as the deterring of traffic, again, these are all residential streets. Trucks are not allowed, you know, unless they're making local deliveries. These are not truck routes. So again, there's really no deterring of traffic in the corridor. So we feel we're fully in compliance with the intent of...
You're telling me if there's no... all sorts of traffic is supposed to go that route? That's not a main route.
It's not a truck route, so as a result...
It shouldn't be a state part of the city system anyway.
It's not a truck route on the city's truck route map, and as a result, there's no deterring of truck traffic through the neighborhoods.
Then problem solved. We can work with the department to remove that portion from the city system. And aside another route, that's more likely for them to...
I'm guessing that this is not problem solved. I'm guessing that there's some consequence for removing it from...
Which consequences?
It was in the email. Either you remove the impediments or they're going to cut your state aid funding.
And no, I never said that. We never said that. There's no, intention to take away the city the ability to use the state aid funds. If there was that intention, it should have been done already. We didn't do that. We're not going to do that. We have no intention of doing that. We want to work together to find solutions together. If there is a problem that you need to use the speed bumps, that's fine. If it's a temporary speed bump, we can talk about that. Okay. If it's a permanent one that fits the purpose of the road in a higher tier route, we can adjust that in the system. No problem.
All right. Ms. Means, do you have a question?
I was going to make a suggestion and have our engineer work with the state engineer.
Well, that's what I was trying to get to as far as next steps. Geez. It just sounds like we have to work with Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so as a practical matter, I mean, it sounds like, you know.
We're good.
Well, that's a true thing. And the state doesn't think that. How hard would it be to switch, you know, which portion? Can we maintain the same miles of state aid road and just reallocate it? How hard is that? And is that a practical solution?
We do have reserve miles, so we can redesignate and undesignate these sections.
Is there a downside to doing that? Or I mean, obviously, it takes work and effort and staff
time. Your state aid miles is calculated, or state aid reimbursement is calculated based on the amount of traffic that operates in the corridor.
Okay.
So streets that we don't have on the system right now are lesser volumes,
right,
typically, than these two, so there would be a slight impact on your annual state aid allocation.
Right. And the state aid allocation has to be applied to the roadway that's designated. Is that true?
Yeah. True. It's applied based on the volume of traffic that's on the roadway.
So I guess I'm just concerned if we were to delineate Fairway Drive, there would be a pot of funding for maintaining Fairway Drive that would then be applied somewhere else in the system.
Yes.
Fairway Drive and the other systems are, the funding is dedicated to the city. Half of it is by population and half of it by the mileage you have in the system.
Okay.
Back when we first originally put the speed tables on in Fox Valley, that was the first one. It wasn't designed that we actually worked with the state aid engineer at the time to ensure that we were maintaining about a 20 mile per hour speed limit even over the speed tables. So we flattened out the ramp, we shortened the height of the table itself. And so the advisory speed limit over those speed tables is no worse than you find in a roundabout, which is also a 15 to 20 mile per hour speed advisory. So we find that, again, like Richard indicated, the corridor speed is still being maintained relatively at the design speed of 30 miles an hour.
Okay, Mr. Wojak?
Well, I would just say I'm sufficiently satisfied we've beaten this dead horse, and I think that when there's consequences that we have to address, I'm sure the city engineer will let us know, and for now I'd just like to take no action and move on.
I just think they're inverted platforms. All right.
I guess I'd like to say thank you.
All right.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for the information.
My pleasure being here.
All right. Thank you. All right. Moving on. This is a topic. Remember that we said that in August we would review the two proposals we have for the Armory building. And
make some course or a selection or decision of some sort. What I wanted to do today is, it, we don't have to take very long, but, you know, maybe a 10-minute conversation of, you know, what kinds of criteria might we use as we individually and then collectively evaluate these proposals going forward. I mean, I'll start because one of the things that I'm going to be looking at is whatever the operational plan is for whatever entity might use the building. I'm prepared to be able to support the structure, the facility itself, as we do other facilities. I'm less enthused about subsidizing whatever might choose to operate in the building. So I'm going to be looking hard at the financial plan or business plan that any organization would bring forward in their proposal. That's all I wanted to do, just see if there was some similarity in thinking in terms of the kinds of things, because you all might have some ideas of things that I hadn't thought of that I might want to look at as I review the proposal. So just some open discussion, really. Anyone? Mr. Hickey?
So we already agreed, you know, we're only going to look at these two proposals for now, but I just want to make sure we're considering the full range of options. You know, when we started this process, you know, we said we weren't sure what we wanted to do with the building. Do we want to sell it? Do we want to repurpose it, you know, with a nonprofit? And we had put out that request for some proposals to get some ideas, and the staff set a date, because you have to have a date to get those proposals in. But I don't think there should be any consideration that, you know, there was two in by this date. That's going to be, one of those two are going to be selected, and that's going to be the final plan. Again, if we decide that we want to sell it, I mean, in the same way we marketed the Quick Trip property next to the fire station, I mean, traditionally you do that through a firm and you actually market it. So I just want to make sure we're considering the full range of possibilities, and we're not getting too focused just on the two that we've heard so far.
Yeah, as I see it, the options that we'll have in August, there's always a do-nothing option, which basically means we end up with an empty building. Doesn't seem viable. We could select one of the two proposals that were presented. We could choose to sell the building and, as you say, market it and sell it. The other option, I suppose, we could reject the proposal we received and start over. So to me, it sounds like those are the main options that we'll have in front of us, Mr. Bildebeck.
Yeah, I think there's been a question whether sell was mentioned before the deadline dates or not, and I think if that's an option, we have to go back and put that in as well. But there's a fourth one that I'm looking at and I'm questioning, and that's if the senior center will be ready to move, or if they'll be out of there at the time that we're talking about. We haven't heard from the senior center in quite some time, and I'm not sure where they're at and what's happening along with their fundraising and other activities. So I think before we get into the idea that they may be ready to move, we should be double-checking with them to make sure that they're going to be able to do what they said they were going to do when the last time we spoke to them. And that's been, I don't remember the last time the senior center was here, but I do believe we should check with them and see where they're at as well. So I think that needs to be taken into account.
I can provide those two items.
Okay. Mr. Woodjack, do
you have any? My take is reviewing the two proposals, nothing is forever. Even speed tables wear down over time, so every speed table is a temporary solution. But I think there's an opportunity here to work with one of these groups in the short run and get them in there. Of course, you know, we don't know what the future is going to hold, but we can do things on a 1 or 2 year pilot basis to see how it operates. We're going to have a certain amount of cost just having the building there, regardless. So that's, you know, that factors into your statement about, you know, how much are we willing to put into the operations versus the building. We don't have an infinite amount of money. I think even had we considered that third proposal, I think what people are forgetting is it's not increasing revenues to anyone. It's transferring revenues from the school district to the city in that particular case. But in reviewing the two proposals, I have some concerns over the financial assumptions that were made in the Veterans Museum proposal. I requested some additional information and read the full study that they provided us back when they first presented to us. I'm much more comfortable with the finances of the arts proposal, in part because, if nothing else, they've so substantially diversified where their revenue sources are coming from, particularly from artists renting space. And I spoke with one of those artists today that talked about herself and some other artists possibly taking a, looking to move into this space potentially. And we know that the model works in terms of engaging people and keeping downtown Rochester active, because we saw that with the salon. So I make no claim as to what the permanent solution would be, but I would like to investigate the Arts Collaborative proposal some more.
Well, let me raise this back up a level. Again, I'm looking at the finances. Give you a couple of other examples. I'm looking in the proposal. Have they fairly articulated the risks to their operation? Are they being realistic about what they're looking at as they would look to operate in that building? I'm also looking at their operational structure and management plan. You know, is it, and I'm making this up, is it one person, or do they have a staff of individuals, and have they really thought that through? So I'm looking at the operational plan. Those are some of the things that I'm looking at as I evaluate the proposals. And I don't know if there are some other kind of high-level things, Mr. Campion?
Yeah, I guess I would. Both of the proposals we had pretty, there was a lot of, I think, assumptions going into them, right? And I think, having seen and done some of these evaluations professionally, there's certainly a lot that goes into that, and it takes quite some time to evaluate a lot of opportunities. But I also operate in an environment where there's a lot more information about, you know, what the market will bear and stuff like that. And I think we're talking to entities that probably don't have unlimited budgets to do those sorts of evaluations. To me, I guess critically speaking, the impact of the group is really important. And I think we have two proposals that are from groups that have articulated a message about how they will impact the community. That, to me, was the important aspect of this. And not everyone is looking at this in the same light, and frankly, I'm kind of happy with that. We all kind of have come into the table with a little bit different perspective on what we're looking to get. I think, like you said, facility support is an important part. We do have to understand the long-range obligation of the city. For me, the other aspect is, what is the impact of the use on the broader community? So let's call it the value statement, if you will. It's something of weighing the costs or the potential costs against the impact of the community. That was how I was sitting down with Tally Marks to try and evaluate some of the proposals we have. And I think, you know, that's inevitably what I kind of boil things down to when it comes to uses of the public good here. I think that's a really important criteria to keep in mind, is it's not, you know, how we gauge, you know, is it the number of people who walk through the doors? Is it the number of tourists who end up getting there? Is it the number of parking slots that get filled? What is it? And I think, you know, again, each one of these demand of us a little bit of flexibility in terms of those measures, because they're hard. So I guess I would offer that to the group.
Yeah, I know. Ideally, you'd have something that's very quantifiable. You score it and make a decision and go. And oftentimes in our arena, that's not the case. So there does have to be some room for interpretation, I guess. So, well, that's all I wanted to do today. And Ms. Means, did you have more comments?
Well, did you read the request for proposal? I don't think I saw it. Or maybe I did and didn't read it. But does it say anything in there about, you know, if the criteria isn't met, we don't know what that is yet, that these two will not be considered, or they will be back in the pool, or?
It says you can reject all proposals.
You can reject
or
all.
Or either proposal.
And then they would have the opportunity. I would hope that if we rejected all the proposals, we'd say why.
Absolutely.
That would give that way, if we chose to take on
the RFPs,
they should have an understanding that they could go back and fix
right.
or work on their proposal. I would
shouldn't
think
be just an arbitrary decision.
Right, and it wouldn't be, in my mind, I don't think I would ever, if we went back and rejected them and reopened, it wouldn't
preclude them.
Yeah, everybody would still have the opportunity to fix their proposals and come back with them. But I do believe that it's important that if we reject them, that we tell them why we're rejecting the proposals.
Sure.
And did it say anything in the proposal about the final submission date is January 10th?
March 31st.
March 31st is final.
Okay, Mr.
So that would exclude accepting any that came after March 31st.
Not if we rejected everything. And then
yes, we'd have to reject
it.
All. Okay.
Well, my biggest thing is, when do we make a decision? There's a lot of people who really want to figure out this because, you know, these groups are not standing still. And I think that that arts group is looking very heavily at this space. They're very invested in it. I think the veterans group is looking both here, and they're talking about the old post office and some other things as well.
Post office is sold.
It's sold to Mayo, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's he used to work for them, right?
I did used to.
But I do think what we really need to we need to make a decision at some point. So if it's going to be rejected, we need to reject. I've stated my opinion publicly, but if we're not going to make a decision, let's tell everyone when we're going to make a decision.
Yeah,
well, I think we had said we wanted to make some decision here in August. I mean, we're either going to move forward with one of these proposals or some other course of action, start over, or whatever. Because I think we owe them that, because any organization is going to need some prep time.
So I'm going to pop open my calendar here, and I'm looking at the at August, and it looks like we've got 5 Mondays in August.
I have tentatively slated August 22nd.
August 22nd.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm on it. Okay.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
So we'll end that one then and move on. We've got two other other business items. Real quickly,
just
I've got one, and I know Michael has
fire away mine short too.
And Mr. Hickey,
quick point. I won't say point of order because that would suggest we're in. But the decision of use will come at the COW, and then we would only have to take an official action if we needed to reject the RFC. Correct.
If you reject all proposals, it'll only be done at a council meeting.
And to adopt one of them as a plan of record, we'd also
at a council meeting.
Okay. Just want to make sure. Thank you.
Okay. I'll do mine. Hopefully, this is very quick. Based on conversation, input from the community, et cetera, beginning our next meeting, we would like to move the Committee of the Whole meetings to the council chambers to be set up similar to the way we set it up for the joint city-county board meeting, except the tables will be a little bit more compressed so that we'll be oriented. We'll be able to see that one screen that's on the east wall or south wall. And is there any, Mr. Hickey?
Just a question. What's the difference in the seating capacity?
Difference
of what? How many seats do we have here and how many seats do we have there?
They have about 110, I think, in that one. This one we probably have 40. You could get more seats in. That's another option. Go ahead.
So, I mean, that's what's on the table. If you, Mr. Freed?
As a person who sat in the audience through some of those recent meetings, we can't hear much of the conversation that takes place at the table. So when you had those meetings, there's been no microphones, no audiovisual really into that other seating area. So just something to think about.
Yeah. Well, and the point is, we don't have that many options in terms of larger gathering space that we don't have to pay for or is accessible to the public. So I'm putting that out there as the only viable option I've heard. If somebody's got another idea, Mr. Hickey?
So obviously if we sit up on the
dais.
Right. We lose the eye contact and around the table, but then you pick up the microphones, and so that's, it depends what we're trying to do here, but if you're trying to make it more accessible for people, they probably want to hear what's going on.
I think what you should consider is that this meeting was somewhat mainly for the council to have their informal meetings to receive information. So I hope you don't lose this closeness back and forth. I actually think the council chambers is less desirable for the citizens to probably more space, but probably they don't get as close. But I would hope at least if you go in there, you set this yourself up like this so that you can have the interaction among yourselves, because that's the main purpose of this meeting.
Right, understood. And that's what I meant when I said the tables would be compressed other than they were for the joint meeting. They'd be set up very much like this. Mr. Reeves had a question?
Well, I was just going to throw out there if you have had a number of requests to live stream from Committee of the Whole meetings because people do have trouble making it at the time. The rooms are full, those sort of things. They can watch them from your desk. They can do whatever. So if we do move the council chambers, we have discussed that we can set it up to live stream in there much easier. We can do microphones on the table. We have a fixed camera. We wouldn't have to, we wouldn't have to pay anybody to do it. It would be a staff person to go back with the switch, and that's how we're kind of set up. But as Stephen talked about, the ability to stay in this room, the benefits, we do have a quote from our vendor to put in a stationary camera here to live stream meetings as well. And so I'm going to talk to him about that actually tomorrow and get that idea. So that, you know, the one thing I would say with that is that it doesn't help your space issue necessarily, but you may not have as many people need to come if they could live stream the meeting and watch it that way. So that may make 104 remain a viable option for these needs if you're interested in live streaming. If we decide we don't want to live stream it, then location is based on space.
All right. So Mr. Newman?
And I don't know how it worked, but we could try one meeting where we've gotten more chairs in here for other events. If you get another four easy over there, another four there, you probably get another row in here if you move this table to one side. Can't guarantee it, but you could get in about you might be able to get a dozen more seats in here if that would.
I know one thing.
I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm just.
Yeah, one thing that could potentially help is if we were a bit more deliberate on our agenda items and time, because conceivably you could have people here in the room for their particular item of interest. Because as we see, people tend to cycle in and out, and we could turn over the room, so to speak.
Yeah, if you put, that was something I think you brought up at one point on the college entrance. If you put a time on who's on there, and they've got a half an hour, and the next one has a half an hour, and the next one has a half an hour, if you kind of stick with that, it might help some.
Yes. So, where do you want to go? I didn't want this to be a protracted discussion. So sure.
Let's do it in the council chambers and try it once and see what happens.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Agree. So we'll move down there, try it, see what happens.
You would have all of this stuff here. I'd stay here. Add some other chairs.
Try it once. If it's a colossal failure, we'll
see, it's easier to add more chairs than it is to add more oxygen.
Well, and I'm not sure what this room's capacity is to.
Yeah, safety.
There's got to be a point where. Sorry, I used to work with that, but so could be an issue with.
What do you want to do? Move it and try it?
Let's try it.
Yes,
try it.
I think we should.
Move it and try it. All right, we'll give it a shot. All right, Mr. Wojcik, you're up.
I have a home on Gates Drive, and it's being considered for a rental permit. I don't know what our ordinances allow, but I don't believe we should allow it to get a rental permit for the reason that the person who acquired it has a little bit of a history doing this. First thing he did is did a unpermitted substantial addition to the lower level, and as best we can tell, carved it up into maybe like 10 boarding units or so, with like the hot plate kitchens and that kind of stuff. We don't know that for sure, but based on the 10 vehicles that were parking there, he initially provided a false statement to staff that in fact he could rent out rooms because he was living there. We know that in fact that statement was false. Now, my understanding is that he is now reverse course and going to try and get a rental permit for the property. I have two issues with that. One, his false statement that he made previously, and two, the fact that he has this unpermitted addition that he did on there, and the property is pretty well trashed too. So I don't know if our ordinances allow for either one of those reasons as cause for denial of a rental permit, but if not, I want to make sure that we have some tools or techniques in place to address this kind of property management scheme.
Mr. Hickey,
what's building safety say?
Building safety and planning have been talking past each other quite a bit, and that's part of the reason why I brought it up here, is I think this is there's probably some gray area in this stuff, but this is pretty clear cut. I mean, the addition was done in the last few months, and they're going to review his rental permit as though they would review any other rental permit, which probably doesn't involve looking at the addition or anything like that.
Has anybody inspected the addition?
I don't. Stephen, did we get him out there today?
Randy Clement was going to be out there to investigate. That's the outside, and the building safety department is reviewing his application for a rental certificate.
The neighbors were kind enough to document the whole addition process for us.
I would hope that they wouldn't issue anything without fully inspecting the facility.
I would think they won't without a full inspection. However, but Michael says since he built this addition without a permit, he shouldn't get a rental certificate at all. We have situations where people have found out where they've been renting illegally. Mm-hmm. Then they come in and get a certificate, and you give them a certificate.
Yep.
So I don't know if it meets all the requirements, I don't know if the denial, I'll never get it from the Terry, but don't know if the denial would be appropriate.
Well, for example, when we go to criminal court, one of the conditions that the court imposes on someone is that you get a rental license, that you comply with the ordinance and go through the hoops and get that license. It would be difficult if the court's imposing that condition for us then to turn around and say, no, we're not going to give you a license because of the, you were convicted for renting without a license. And so we have to be careful. And I don't know the facts of this case, which is hamstringing me, quite frankly. But a blanket, we shouldn't give licenses to people who have been convicted for renting illegally. Will cause a problem if a court has imposed as a condition of the sentence, you get a license.
Okay. Is there conditions we can put on that license?
I believe so, yes.
I would assume that whoever, if they get the license, they have to meet all the requirements of the rental
right, but
housing
since,
code.
Since we had issues with them prior to, is there additional requirements we put on, can we put on the license?
I don't think the additional legal requirements.
Again, I just don't know what the facts are here.
Okay. I'm not really familiar with
it. It's hard to respond.
All right, I'm going to go to Ms. Means.
You know, I want to say that I had a similar recent issue, and I can't applaud Building Safety and Randy Clemens for responding to that request and identifying there wasn't a license, identifying that there was an illegal driveway dug that should have been, you know, covered up with cement or something. And they cited that homeowner with several issues that need to be repaired and made more suitable. So they've not crossed, I've not had any misconnections with them at all. And I just want, my experience has been positive over the years with them. But I know that happens. And this, and not only that, this particular neighbor also had a business and had his business machines out there. It's like having a cement truck out in front of your house or something. So,
okay. Mr. Wojcik?
Ultimately, what I would like, if this is going to become a rental property, I want to ensure that all the work that's been done without permit is inspected, which is probably going to mean mm-hmm. they're tearing out drywall and those sorts of things, mm-hmm. which I'm quite okay with. The real issue here, too, is it's the, you know, if it were a rental permit, it's a single-family neighborhood, and I assume they can't subdivide that. I believe that's been taken care of for the most part, but the fact that there were 10 vehicles parking at this single-family home, and I think it was basically, you know, a bunch of different families that were all living there in a boarding house situation, but I want to make sure that we don't, that all of these questions are answered and resolved before staff issues the rental permit. And we don't need definitive guidance today other than to say that that is a reasonable request and figure out how staff can get back to us on how they choose to implement that or if we need to take action to make that possible.
It sounded like, based on the emails, there was actually some property or site inspections occurring today, this afternoon, so.
As a result, probably, of this talk.
Could very well be. So, what are you suggesting? Do you want to have a report back at the next committee of the whole?
Maybe the correct action. Well, what do you think?
I understand what he's saying, and we'll give you a report on what the situation is and how they may comply.
Either via email or
right.
next
yeah.
Monday for sure.
I mean, if it's going to be a rental property, the work has to be fully inspected, and it's got to be one family, not this boarding house stuff that they're trying to
do. And so, Michael, I do believe that we should look at what our options are to add additional checks or counterbalances and make sure that we can, it stays that way too.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we'll get some more information on that. Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, this is something I've been dealing with all summer, and we're running out of summer. I was going to see if we could collectively ask the Parks Department to get back to us with what it would cost to supplement the boulevard tree trimming with a contractor during kind of these critical summer months. Obviously, the Forestry Division is taxed, and they do most of their tree trimming in the off-season. This time of year, they really don't have a lot of resources for it. But the problem is, you know, people, since that early growth in the spring, I've had people contact me about the same trees that are blocking the sidewalk. We generally don't allow people to trim their own trees. We tell them we don't have time to do their trees. They're on a 10-year cycle, but yet people can't get down the sidewalk. So it seems like something that maybe we could supplement with a contractor. So if we could have Park and Rec at least get us a price and how feasible it would be to do that. But time is of the essence. Here we are in the middle of July or end of July. So
early July. Let's, okay. We want July to last.
Is there any
So
if we direct Park and Rec just to at least get us a price, and
we'll get a response.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, thank you. All right. Okay, anything else for this afternoon?
This wasn't about a pine tree.
All right, then we are adjourned.
These are boulevard trees out in the city.